the Tacoma smelter, and was really excited about coming up here and being able to make the link between the Tacoma smelter and Holden, because of course Holden started as a mine. We all know that the Holden mine is long since closed, and likewise the Asarco smelter in Tacoma is also closed. So maybe my title ought to be Death of a Mine, Death of a Smelter. And I'd like to talk a little bit about why both have closed in the whole process of the extractive industry in the U.S. and in the world. Please feel free to interrupt me at any time. I'd love some discussion, so feel free to speak up. What I want to talk about today is, first of all, where do we get copper as a metal? Because, of course, it's very important in electrical wiring and a variety of other common commercial uses. How should an industry, any industry, be regulated? And is it fair to change the rules in the middle of the game? And what happens when a dirty industry shuts down? And finally, how clean is clean, if we get to it? Probably I'll spend less time on this because of the fact the Asarco smelter has closed, and so it's no longer an industry that's being regulated. Rather, today it's a shutdown industry that is in the process of cleanup. Well, most of you probably remember something from high school or college about the Bronze Age and the fact that copper was one of the very first metals that human beings worked with. Copper mining, of course, is an extractive industry, and the first literature site I've been able to find happens to be in Deuteronomy 8, verse 9 and 10, where the Hebrews are going into the Promised Land, and I won't read all of it to you, but a land in which you will eat bread without scarcity, for which you will lack nothing, a land whose stones are iron, and out of whose hills you can dig copper. Those of you who are into a little less high-class literature may have read the Pollard series, which talks about, of course, copper and tin mining in Cornwall about the end of the 18th century, beginning of the 19th century, along with a lot of other potboiler stuff in it. But it really does give you a little hint of the copper industry. The Asarco smelter was founded because of the discovery of copper in Alaska. And the Kennecott mines in Alaska produced copper that was up to 70% copper by weight. So very large, very high quantity of copper in that ore. That was in about 1890 or so, and the Asarco smelter became solely a copper smelter about 1905. Holden, of course, became a mine, an active mine, in about 1938, and you can see that it was obviously pretty low-quality ore as compared to the ore that had come from Alaska. This is very typical of what happened in the mining industry from the turn of the last century through the 1930s and 40s. We used up most of our best ore. Of course, the very best ore in the world, and certainly in the United States, came from northern Michigan and the Keweenaw Peninsula, where you could find hunks of pure copper. And Native Americans started using pure copper from the Keweenaw in about 200 BC. Present-day mining averages about 0.7% copper by weight in the ore, and that's not bad. If you look at where we get our ore today, the U.S. is still the largest producer of copper in the world, with most of it coming from Arizona and New Mexico, some from Utah, some from Nevada. Canada is next, USSR is next. Mexico also produces copper ore today, as well as Australia, Philippines, Chile, Peru, Zaire, and Zambia, which are off the bottom. Well, I said the Asarco smelter was founded in 1888. It was actually founded by a guy named William Rust, and the town that the Asarco smelter is in is completely surrounded by Tacoma, but the town is called Ruston, named after him. 1905, the Guggenheim family from New York bought it, and the name of the company was changed to American Smelting and Refining, later to be abbreviated ASARCO. For those of you who aren't from Western Washington, let me just remind you that we have Puget Sound, the lower 48 fjord, a very deep body of water, which I'll be talking about next week. Tacoma is located right down here at the southern part of Puget Sound, but it's still a very deep water port. Commencement Bay is about 450 feet deep at its deepest point, and that's very close off the banks of ASARCO. The ASARCO smelter has some kind of unique characteristics. First of all, it was a custom smelter. That meant it could get ore from almost anywhere. Somebody delivered their ore to the smelter, and the smelter would then give them that amount of copper, or that amount of silver and gold, or whatever else came from the ore. And of course, ASARCO also brought its own ore to the smelter as well. So the ore from here probably went to the ASARCO smelter as a custom ore. Another characteristic of the smelter is there are no copper mines nearby. It isn't like Bisbee, Arizona, where the smelter was here and the mine was a mile or two away. This was by far the closest mine to ASARCO in its entire history. Like I said, it was founded to get ore from Alaska, and during many of the last years of operation, most of the ore came from the Philippines, Chile, Peru, Canada, and from scrap metal. It was the only U.S. copper smelter with a deep water port, and that's been since 1974. Anybody here from Baltimore? Baltimore was the other smelter with a deep water port. Any of you have been in the harborfront area of Baltimore? That smelter was right down there, just to the east of what's now the ritzy part of the redevelopment. ASARCO walked away from that smelter in 1974. From 1970 on, production at the smelter decreased. Part of that was because of the copper market through the 1970s and the price of copper being very low. 1970, it got about 400,000 tons of concentrate, which is about 20% copper. By 1979, that was down to about 200,000 tons of concentrate, and they began finally to recycle some copper scrap at the smelter. And then the very unique characteristic of this smelter, the fact that it processed high arsenic ore, much of which came from the Philippines, Peru, and Chile. It blended the ore, or the concentrate, with low arsenic ore until it was about 4% by weight arsenic. For much of its life, this was the only smelter in the United States that could smelt high arsenic ore, and on top of that, it was responsible for making most of our arsenic. And I'll come back to that in just a sec.
Sherry?
Yeah?
Was the arsenic naturally present in the copper ore?
Yeah, the arsenic was naturally present in the copper ore. Now, there's some indication that here they may have added some arsenic as well in the process. I just read that up at the mine. But I don't know about that.
That's what Rudy was saying. They added arsenic to change the characteristics of the.
But most of the arsenic in the ore, most of the arsenic in the concentrate was naturally there from other sources, particularly the Philippines. Yeah.
I understand arsenic is part of the leaching process for extracting gold from the ore.
Oh, okay.
So they probably would have added arsenic to leach the gold out of the hole in the tailings.
Yeah. Which is also why they added the cyanide. The other compound that they added here was called xanthates, which is any chemist in the audience, a thiocarbonate, and it helped make the copper-containing materials float while the iron materials sunk in the process up the hill here. Okay, the products from the smelter were, of course, copper. Silver and gold generally come along with copper, as does platinum and palladium in much smaller amounts. Arsenic trioxide, metallic arsenic, nickel sulfate, sulfuric acid, liquid sulfur dioxide, and slag were the products of the smelter. Slag was the leftover rock-like material. We'll talk about that more in a minute. It was particularly used, it's been used for riprap or great big boulders to stabilize banks. Sandblasting grit, particularly in the ship industry, ship painting. Roadway ballast in the log sort yards in Tacoma, essentially gravel, as well as ornamental rock all over Tacoma. The ones with the red marks were products during the last years of the smelter from about 1970 on. Metallic arsenic and nickel sulfate were products of earlier years of operation. And apparently ASARCO had a big enough stock of metallic arsenic that they just didn't make it after a while. If we take a look at the smelting process, any chemists in the audience? Okay, well, this is a little bit streamlined. I'd be happy to discuss the chemistry of it with any chemists later on. But we start out with either a copper sulfide concentrate or a copper oxide concentrate. Most of the smelters in the U.S. Use copper sulfide concentrates that would come from the mine. As I said earlier, the Holden mine had about 2% copper in its ore by weight. So right here, it was concentrated to about 20% copper in the concentrate by weight. So the stuff when it arrived at the smelter was about 20% copper and about 80% other stuff. And the other stuff is what we want to get rid of in the smelting process. The process used three furnaces and added oxygen and essentially heated it up to the point of melting. You'd get a chemical reaction going on, so the copper would get reduced to metallic copper. We'd produce slag, and there'd also be silicates in this slag as well, and sulfur dioxide gas. So one of the big concerns of the smelter then was the fact that we made sulfur dioxide gas.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've been talking about arsenic. Was that in the S3?
It was part of the other stuff here, and it was mainly oxides of arsenic.
But it's not in this equation.
I'll get to that.
Okay.
This is the smelting process per se.
Okay.
We'll get to the arsenic in just a sec. Okay, as I said, the concentrate comes from the mine. The first step is called the roaster. Second step, the reverberatory furnace. Third step, the converter furnace. At that point, we'd have a product called blister copper, which would be about 97 to 99% pure copper. From there, it'd get cast into an anode, essentially melted and shaped, and the copper anodes would get shipped to Amarillo, Texas, where they were refined. Up until 1979, there was a refinery in Tacoma, but it closed in 1979, and the new refinery was built by ASARCO in Amarillo, Texas. If we look at the actual smelter, this is a diagram from an EPA document. Essentially, the copper concentrate would come into the roaster where it would get heated up to drive off anything that was volatile or would evaporate. That includes sulfur dioxide, any organics that might be present, and antimony and arsenic. They'd get driven off here. After it was roasted, the material was called a calcine, and the calcine containing the copper was delivered to the reverberatory furnace. That was a furnace lined with bricks, which would get long flat things, which would get heated up really hot, and the ceiling was designed so it would reflect heat back down onto the calcine, and you begin to get copper forming that would sink in a layer on the bottom, and slag forming on a layer on the top. So we take off slag, molten slag, and put it in little rail cars and drive it out to the slag piles. It also drained off the copper, and that copper was called matte. It was about 50 to 60% pure copper. The matte then would get stuck into the third furnace, the converter, and the converter then would heat it up with more oxygen to make the blister copper, which I said was about 99% pure, and that it ultimately gets shaped and go to Texas. Roaster. Said volatiles would come off the roaster, gases and various particulates. Those would then go to the bag house where the dust would get collected. That dust went to something called the arsenic kitchen, which is where the arsenic was roasted and converted into arsenic trioxide or metallic arsenic. This was a feature specific to the Tacoma smelter. We'd also get that slag that I mentioned coming off there as a byproduct.
Was the bag house there from the very beginning?
There were two bag yes, there were bag houses there from the very beginning, but yes, there were more bag houses proposed for construction later on. And there were additional bag houses constructed later on, and EPA wanted yet a third set of bag houses to get built. So the bag house was initially there to collect arsenic.
Just what was commercially feasible.
Commercial product, exactly. We produced sulfur dioxide at the roaster. That went up the stack. Sulfur dioxide at the reverberatory furnace. That went up the stack. And at the converter furnace, we produced sulfur dioxide that got converted into sulfuric acid, again as a commercial product. And then later on, they built a liquid sulfur dioxide plant that again produced sulfur dioxide as a commercial product. Also from the converter process, we'd get lead dust. It was heated up enough, hot enough at this point that it'd make the lead come off as a gas. Collect the lead dust, and that went to the Asarco smelter at East Helena, Montana, which is a smelter that still operates today. So, at this point, we have the products from the smelter. The copper, various precious metals, and the sulfur dioxide and the arsenic. Those were the two big concerns in the regulatory process, the sulfur dioxide and the arsenic. Okay, any comments about the smelter process? Yeah?
Where did they pick off the gold?
Okay, gold, silver, platinum, and palladium are, of course, pretty inert. That's why we make rings out of gold, etc. And because of that, they just get carried through the process. So when I said these copper anodes are somewhere over 99% pure, the 1% is largely those precious metals. So the precious metals that get refined at the refinery in Amarillo, Texas. Early on, they were refined in Tacoma, but then later on in Texas. So that's carried through to the end of the process. The copper that we get out of the refinery would be adequate for electrical wire, and that means it's 99.97% pure or greater, with the rest of it being a little bit of oxygen, so it conducts electricity better. See, there was one other point I wanted to make here. Oh, well. Come back to me later. Sulfur dioxide, which went up the main stack, the emissions from the Asarco smelter were at about 80,000 tons per year in 1980, and that varied between 0.2 and 22 tons per hour, and that was after the liquid sulfur dioxide and the sulfuric acid plants were built. So that was at about 50% removal. After 50% removal, about 80,000 tons per year went up the stacks. Jill Whitman will be talking about the eruption of Mount St. Helens later this week. And of course, you all know that when a volcano erupts, you get a lot of sulfur-containing gases. It's estimated that the year Mount St. Helens erupted, it produced about 80,000 tons of sulfur dioxide, roughly. So the year Mount St. Helens erupted, it had roughly the same amount of emissions that the Asarco smelter produced every year.
Is that, that was the smell that hung over Tacoma all the time?
The aroma of Tacoma. No, that wasn't the smell that hung over Tacoma. Sulfur dioxide forms sulfuric acid in your lungs, sulfur trioxide, then sulfuric acid. So it makes your eyes burn and it makes your lungs hurt if you breathe enough of it. It smells sharp. It doesn't stink. It's actually very dangerous. By the time it gets to high enough concentration, you can smell it. You're at a high enough level that asthmatics are not going to be feeling real good at all. What the aroma of Tacoma is about three or four things. The paper plant, the rendering plant, which is actually right by the freeway and renders all the dead animals from southwestern Washington. The hot dog factory that used to be there and is now closed, and a drywall plant. So the aroma of Tacoma was unfairly blamed on the smelter, and we can blame lots of things on the smelter, but the aroma is not one of them. Good question, though. The other things that went up the stack, up the main stack, was arsenic, and about 47% of the dust by weight was arsenic, lead, zinc, copper, cadmium, chromium, and mercury. And of these, the ones that are continuing problems around Tacoma are, shouldn't have marked copper there, are lead, cadmium, chromium. Particularly lead and cadmium are the chemicals of which we're continuing to be concerned about, as well as of course, as the arsenic. Because, of course, what goes up comes down. Any of you from Idaho, western Idaho, Panhandle?
Well, south Idaho, not north.
You may be aware of some of the controversies relative to the related to the Bunker Hill smelter. If you go to Montana, you have the Anaconda smelter, the Kennecott smelter. If you go to the southwest, you have a number of other smelters. The smelters all have similar kinds of environmental issues around them, with the exception of the arsenic, which is unique to Tacoma. Well, this figure is very busy, and I thought about not putting it up here, but it serves a purpose, and that purpose is to move into the next phase of what I want to talk about, the regulatory angles. As I said, the smelter began operations in 1888, and from 1888 until 1969, it basically did pretty much what it wanted. There's some cases where they were unhappy about, where they, meaning the state, was unhappy about water pollution. The plume was pretty opaque, it was pretty black. But basically, the smelter made decisions based on economics. Well, 1969 was about the time that people started to get very concerned about the environment. The Environmental Protection Agency was established the next year in 1971. The first Clean Air Act was passed in 1970, and it was estimated that 92% of the SO2 sulfur dioxide emitted in Pierce County came from Asarco, and over 70% of the sulfur dioxide in western Washington came from Asarco. So Asarco became a very visible symbol in the community of the pollution that existed in Tacoma, and for that matter in all of the state of Washington, and later on nationally as well. So the regulatory scheme started, and it's all interwoven, and the purpose of this long list is to show you that there were lots of things going on. Basically, sulfur dioxide and arsenic regulations were proposed, and That happened in 1971 and 1973. 71 for sulfur dioxide, 73 for arsenic. First Clean Air Act said you shall control 90% of your sulfur dioxide emissions. EPA also told ASARCO that they shall control arsenic emissions. In addition, the state agency said the same thing, as well as the local agency that had been established. ASARCO said that arsenic controls were contingent on the sulfur dioxide plant, and then the next year they said that they couldn't afford to build a sulfur dioxide plant that could remove 90%. And that started a long legal process of regulations, appeals, variances or allowances to be at a level above what the regulation said, followed by further legal action, followed by further appeals, through to the 1980s. So the 1970s were a decade of various kinds of legal actions. Finally, in 1983, ASARCO said they were going to get the permits to go ahead and install the equipment. In 1984, another interesting twist happened. And that was the state of New Jersey sued the state of New York. And they sued the state of New York over arsenic being emitted by the glass industry in New York and blowing into New Jersey. Well, the state of New Jersey won. And EPA got told by the federal courts that they should put arsenic regs in place. Well, the largest arsenic emitter in the nation was in Tacoma. So that legal action immediately triggered a new process in Tacoma. And Bill Ruckelshaus, head of EPA at that point in time, said, the community needs a role in this. The community needs a say in what kind of cancer risk they're willing to accept. So 3 days of public hearings were held. A friend of mine did his PhD thesis on what public perceptions were. Public perceptions didn't seem to matter a whole lot as to what people knew. They did matter somewhat on who their employer was. And there was a real sense of jobs versus the environment in Tacoma at that point in time. There were 575 workers at the smelter. And smelter workers were certain that they ran a big risk of losing their jobs. Well, at the end of the public hearing process, EPA and ASARCO agreed on a scheme to control arsenic emissions. Unfortunately, 2 months after that scheme was agreed to, ASARCO announced the plant was closing, and it closed in June of 1985. My evaluation of why the plant closed was old. Much of the equipment had been installed in 1916. While it had been updated, it was basically a worn-out plant. In the meanwhile, ASARCO built a new plant in Hayden, Arizona, which they tore down their old plant in Hayden, Arizona, and they opened a new plant. And when that new plant was ready to open, they announced the closure of the Tacoma plant. That brought us into a whole new phase. And that new phase, actually I want to say a couple things about arsenic first.
I heard yeah. It also built a plant in the Philippines.
Yeah, I kind of skipped over that. There was a plant in the Philippines built. It was not built by ASARCO, although ASARCO had an interest in it. Ferdinand Marcos had big plans for a giant smelter. The plans for that smelter kind of evaporated as Ferdinand Marcos began to lose power, but there was a smaller smelter actually built in the Philippines. That's right. You know, that certainly played a role in ASARCO deciding what to do with the plant in Tacoma, but I think rebuilding the plant in Hayden, Arizona probably had more to do with ASARCO's corporate decisions than what Ferdinand Marcos ended up doing or not doing. Other comments? If we take a look at the arsenic emissions from the plant from 1971 to 1980, and the data from 1980 to 1985 is low-level emissions, or level emissions from anywhere in the plant except for the tall stack. By the way, the tall stack is 565 feet tall. It was built that tall in 1916. ASARCO solution in the early 1970s for the sulfur dioxide problem was to build a taller stack. They wanted to increase the height to 1,000 feet, and EPA said no. That 565-foot stack is still standing in Tacoma, and it's kind of one of the real landmarks of Tacoma. It will likely come down soon one way or another because after cooling off, it's very unstable. And EPA and ASARCO are arguing over how it's going to come down, but it may come down by itself if they continue to argue. There's debate over whether it's 9 feet off center or 25 feet off center, but it's leaning. So you take the average and say, well, it's 16 feet off center. Anyway, we had low-level emissions of arsenic, and you can see over the 1970s, they dropped pretty dramatically as the smelter kind of nailed plywood up and nailed up tin sheeting and plugged up holes in the smelter. The tall stack emissions took a big drop here, and that, of course, was when the sulfur dioxide plant was built and opened up. And as the sulfur dioxide plant was built and opened up, they had to clean up the gases a little bit more before they hit the sulfur dioxide plant, because otherwise it would have crudded up the sulfur dioxide plant too much. And then continued to drop off a bit during the 70s to 80s, largely because of decreased production. Some of this was also decrease in production right here. About 200 tons of arsenic trioxide per year was being emitted from the smelter. But there was also a negative arsenic balance, which means that they knew there was more arsenic coming into the plant than they could account for, either as low-level emissions or up the stack. I mentioned sulfur dioxide health risks, and I'd just like to mention briefly arsenic health risks. Arsenic trioxide, and no other arsenic compound in particular, has been shown to cause cancer in laboratory animals. If you look at smelter worker populations, however, in Japan you can find a 4 to 12-fold increase of lung cancer in smelter worker populations, and in Tacoma there was a 3 to 8-fold increase in lung cancer in smelter workers. The company doctor at ASARCO did not ever report an increase in lung cancer cases. But these were cases the state and NIOSH, the federal folks, found. In addition, there was no healthy worker effect seen in smelter workers. What I mean by healthy worker effect is that the working population is healthier than the general population, because, of course, the general population includes everybody, and sick people generally don't work. So generally, you'll find a healthy worker effect if you just compare the general population and a working population. And this wasn't seen at the ASARCO smelter. In that big regulatory mess I showed you, one of the things buried in there was the fact that OSHA, occupational safety and health people, proposed in-plant regulations for arsenic. In May of 1978, they dropped the maximum amount of arsenic that workers could be exposed to from 500 micrograms per cubic meter of air down to 10. The plant manager said that standard was, quote, unattainable because it was higher than that in his office, And in the plant, it was as high as 700 micrograms. The net effect was that workers in the plant were required to wear respirators and were also required to keep their cigarettes covered, etc. By the way, there is a dramatic synergistic effect between arsenic exposure and lung cancer, and that's probably a portion of the reason that many of the workers in the plant, or some of the workers in the plant, did develop lung cancer. Okay, we saw all this arsenic was going up the stacks, and obviously it's going to come down somewhere. Well, it was coming down in the neighborhoods. So, of course, people got concerned about the kids in the neighborhoods. And in the 1970s, there were a lot of studies done of the kids in the neighborhoods. One of the things they looked at was arsenic in the kids' urine and hair. And here's some urinary arsenic data. This happens to come from our State Department of Social and Health Services. And as I mentioned before, Ruston was the name of the little town, and they went to the Ruston school and measured arsenic in the urine. And in preschool kids in 1972 found it as high as 270 micrograms per liter, whereas in the control population, south of the Sarco, about 7 or 8 miles, they found it at about 20 to 25 micrograms per liter. On average, the kids had arsenic level in their urine about 4 or 5 times as high as the kids in the control area. Late mid-1970s, they figured out seafood had a little bit of an effect. ASARCO went out then and started collecting their same data. They used the same grade levels. And even though arsenic was decreasing in the emissions, with the exception of this higher number, these numbers were statistically pretty much the same as the arsenic decreased, and their control numbers were a little bit lower, so their conclusions were about the same. The kids had elevated levels of arsenic in their urine. In the 1980s, the federal government came in and paid for a major study. It started while the smelter was still operating and actually has continued to today. And little kids still have elevated levels of arsenic in their urine, particularly little boys who are preschool, because obviously they're close to the ground and they play in the dirt a lot. And they're getting the contamination largely through dirt on their hands. There's a big program in the neighborhood to get kids to be cleaner, but you know how that goes. What are the health effects of arsenic in kids' urine? Nobody can find any. There was a lower incidence of bee stings at the local school, largely because there weren't any bees there. The bees were dead. But other than the lower incidence of bee stings, there were no other health effects found. One problem is it's a relatively blue-collar, low-income area right around the smelter. Smelter workers didn't live there anymore. Their incomes were high enough. They lived far away. And because it was a low-income area, people tended to be pretty transitory. They tended not to stay there very long. So they don't have many longitudinal studies of people who've lived there their entire lives. The database is not very good for a lot of reasons. But other than the risk of increased cancer among the workers, the health data is pretty spotty.
What diameter radius are you looking at when you say the people are transitory?
About a mile and a half south, and it's a deep water port, so it's located right on the bay. So north of the smelter, you have open water until you get to an island called Moray Island, which is a few miles away. And the tip of Moray Island has elevated levels of arsenic as well, and those kids were looked at too. So just make kind of a big loop that goes in the southwesterly direction about a mile and a half south of the smelter.
I'm not sure how transitory it is. That's a pretty large area north of the colony.
Yeah. Well, it's a narrow area, though.
Yeah.
If you're from Tacoma, you know that the wind kind of blows in the northeasterly, southwesterly direction. So it kind of forms a swath across there. So if you go very far east or very far west of the smelter, the arsenic levels drop off very rapidly.
I was wondering if you were going to show or give your opinion of what is the affected area of the sulfur dioxide in the arsenic. You know, prevailing wind is from the southwest, therefore, how far does that extend? And what should you see in that zone?
I meant to bring a lot. I had some maps that show concentration gradients, and I got here and found out they're still in Tacoma. But if you look at the concentration gradients, right at the base of the stack, the concentration of arsenic in the soil is up to 15 or 20% by weight. If you go away from the stack in a southwesterly direction to the plant boundary, you're already down to, say, 2,500, anywhere from 500 to 2,500 parts per million. So you're already talking very dramatic decrease. Then as you continue to go away from the stack, you know, you get about a mile south, and the levels are getting relatively low. And can anybody else hear from Tacoma? By the time you get down, 47th and Basalt is very close, is play yard that's been of great concern. But as you get down to about, 36, between 30th and 36th, you're starting to get to a fairly low concentration. That neighborhood is slated for some kind of action. And the question is, what kind of action? And this is the last phase. Since closure in 1985, the site has been a federal Superfund site. ASARCO is still in the neighborhood. They still own the property. They're, of course, a multinational corporation. They're listed in the New York Stock Exchange. The price of their stock today was about 25. Friday was about 25. They want to stay in business, but they're stuck with the liability of this site. So, what's going to happen? Well, they have on-site responsibilities, where, as I said a second ago, they have very high levels of arsenic. The sulfur dioxide is largely gone. The soil's a little bit acid, but not of their very great concern. The arsenic and the stuff that goes along with it, the cadmium, the lead, chromium, are of concern, particularly cadmium and lead, and, of course, arsenic. So on-site, they're going to have to do a Superfund cleanup. Off-site, we've got this local community, an area of a few square miles that has elevated levels of arsenic and kids with elevated levels of arsenic in their urine. There's soil contamination. Arsenic in the soil is going to stay there essentially forever unless you bring new soil in or take that soil away. Then around Tacoma, we have slag that was used both as ornamental rock work as well as in the log sort yards. And that's a very amusing case. ASARCO sold slag to a subsidiary that sold slag to Louisiana Pacific and a variety of other, Murray Pacific and a variety of other log exporters. Those log export companies used this slag, like I said, as ballast for running their heavy equipment over. You have logs, and you have slag, and you have Pacific Northwest rain, and the rain runs down through the logs and then down through the squashed slag and into the mud and washed high concentrations of metals out into our waterways in Tacoma. Those became Superfund sites because of those high concentrations of metals in the bottom sediments of the waterways. Murray Pacific and Louisiana Pacific and a bunch of the other companies were under order to clean up. They sued ASARCO. ASARCO countersued them. Both of them also countersued the subsidiary or the company that acted as the intermediary. Last I heard, which was about 2 months ago, ASARCO have lost in court and it has a good share of the legal responsibility for that contamination in the bays. But that discussion isn't over yet. As you saw earlier with the litany of suits that ASARCO has been involved in the past, they have good lawyers and they ain't about to stop on that one yet. At any rate, they have off-site contamination in the community, and they also have off-site contamination underwater. The slag dumping operation dumps slag onto land, and it slowly grew and grew and grew. Any of you have been to Tacoma know the Tacoma Yacht Club sits on some of this slag. Their slag handling practices up until about 1980 were such that they would dump the slag over toward the waterside, and it would run down into the bay. And so for about, 60 acres or so out in the bay, there's slag on the bottom. Fortunately, it's the best story of the lot. When they stopped dumping slag there, the area was basically dead. There was nothing living out there. But the surveys last year and this year, just 3 or 4 years after they stopped dumping it, showed that marine life is moving back in and the population's beginning to look healthy. So this may well be an example where the environment heals itself and Asarco ends up having to do only a little bit of work out there. These two stories are not so promising. Asarco claims they've already spent $28 million in the cleanup process. I have no idea what the dollar amount is, but I know whatever it is, they're going to end up spending a lot more before they're done. Our current scheme is to have a major soil removal in the local community. What Asarco would like to do is take that soil and build a contained landfill on site. Needless to say, the people in the community aren't real keen about the idea of having a permanent arsenic landfill, no matter how well designed it is. Again, right in their neighborhoods, and of course the city of Ruston then doesn't have the potential for the economic development that they would like for the site. It's also, other than the fact that there are the remains of a smelter there, some of the most lovely, potentially lovely waterfront property we have in all of Tacoma. But Asarco does intend it to either be a landfill or some kind of light industrial site in the future. What level are they going to decide to use? What concentration? That determines how much soil they will have to remove. Hasn't been set yet. That level is still up in the air. They have removed soil from 11 sites around the community. All those 11 sites are sites where there were no homes, but were privately owned. And they came in and removed somewhere between 9 and 12 inches of soil, well, anywhere from 3 to 12 inches of soil from the site, and brought in fresh topsoil. One of the big long-term issues with the remaining houses as they remove soil is, will there be legal covenants that determine what the individual homeowners can do on those sites? Asarco wants covenants on any site where they do cleanup that says that the homeowner will be precluded from certain activities. What that means in terms of digging a new basement, for instance, remains to be seen. Can you dig a new basement on your property? If so, what do you do with the soil that's contaminated with arsenic? That's an open discussion. And it's, again, something that the residents will play a big role in determining how far EPA and Asarco move in either direction in the ultimate level of cleanup. Likewise, whether or not a landfill ends up on site. It's still an open issue. My gut feeling is that issue probably won't be resolved until about 1995 and 1996 at the rate they're going on the discussion about taking the stack down.
What about like Vashon Island, which is across the way? Wasn't the wind sort of blowing in that?
Vashon Island has essentially been dropped off the discussion. Because the levels out there of contamination are low enough that even though some people are precluded from growing certain vegetables in their garden, particularly, shouldn't grow, if you have arsenic levels of greater than 25 parts per million or cadmium levels greater than 0.2 or 0.3 parts per million, you shouldn't grow cabbage-like vegetables, cool crops. And, the health department used to tell people about it, and they don't tell them anymore. But people on the very south end of Maury Island probably shouldn't be growing those kinds of vegetables. There's no cleanup planned over there at all. Yeah?
Yeah, what about the railroad? I believe they view the slag and its balance, and this goes all the way down to the tip of the beach.
The there's ballast, there's slag all over Tacoma. And the health department's had a big discussion over, do we figure out where the slag is or not, And city council has told them, yeah, you guys really ought to figure out where it is. Slag that's just sitting there as ornamental rock is basically inert. The problem is the situation where they have all these logs and all this squashed bark. But what's the long-term legal liability? You know, if the Sarco's long gone and somebody decides that the slag is a problem, who's going to remove it or who's going to do something about it? And that's why the health department wants people to figure out where it is, at least right now. But you're right, the railroads used it as ballast. The Bremerton shipyard has used hundreds of tons of it as sandblasting grit for the shipping, for painting ships. And a lot of that has gone to the Bremerton landfill. And it's mixed in with lead from ship bottoms and copper from ship bottoms and tin from ship bottoms and everything else under the soot. Who's got the legal liability for that?
Have they removed everything in the smelter except this tank?
No. Sarco and the EPA can't even agree on how you tear down a building. And there's a demolition plan that's been developed by Sarco, and EPA says that it doesn't have adequate dust suppression right now, and there's too much arsenic on site not to have adequate dust suppression. And, you know, great concern about, because the levels are so high on site, there's great concern about stirring up that dust and having it blow over the neighborhood, just like there was concern about the tailings out here blowing around. Except probably there ought to be more concern about the dust at Sarco. Part of the smelter has, part of the sulfur dioxide plant has been put on barges and just gone to Peru in the last 6 months to a year. Sarco tried to sell a lot of the smelter and nobody buy it. Basically, demolition is going very, very, very slowly. The arsenic kitchens were torn down first, and they kind of cleaned out the arsenic in there. There's lots of arsenic in the stack, and that's one of the reasons why they're concerned about how the stack is taken down, because when that stack is taken down, lots of arsenic dust is going to get knocked loose. And they estimate, you know, hundreds of tons of arsenic dust in the stack. Sarco is very good about when something is recyclable, when something's a product, taking it somewhere. And smelting it or selling it to someone who can smelt it. So you know, they're definitely scrapping everything they can. But, you know, the issue, what happens when a dirty industry shuts down is really very much a wide open issue. And an even more wide open issue is how clean do we expect a Sarco to make the site as it leaves it, let alone the neighborhood? And frankly, you can say that about absolutely any smelter anywhere in the nation that shuts down. And lastly, are we just exporting our problems to the third world as countries like Peru and Philippines built smelters? Comments?
Where Sun Valley, Idaho is, most everybody knows now. At one time, there was a large smelter there. And nobody ever said anything about that. That's grown up to where I don't think even anybody's ever said anything about it. Even Nevada has a gigantic stack still standing there. Nothing doing anything there.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there's not much population there either.
Right. Sun Valley certainly. Probably people from EPA have been out there poking around and taking soil samples, because EPA has been poking around most everywhere there was an old smelter. But yeah, we have a lot of cleanup sites in the country. Pierce County alone, we have 47 Superfund sites. Yeah.
Well, it's still a question, but Dixie Lee Ray has written a book recently. She's apparently questioning a lot of the same things that you are. What, have you read her book? I haven't yet.
I've read parts of it. Let's just say that I think she's willing to accept a lot greater health risks than I'm willing to accept. Particularly, Dixie Lee Ray is former governor of the state of Washington and former head of the Atomic Energy Commission, and I might point out that she was head of the AEC when Three Mile Island was sighted. Dixie and I don't see eye to eye on lots of things, and one of them would be on how clean is clean. That I guess I figure part of making a mess is coming in and taking care of the mess you've made. And in her opinion, the mess will just slowly get diluted by human activity.
Well, I don't disagree with anything that you've shown us, but yet I do not see any evidence of acid rain kill in the plume area from the smelter. So I'm wondering, I'm kind of glad it's closed, but I'm wondering,
What harm did it do?
Yeah.
You know, I guess the sulfur dioxide emitted from the smelter bothered me, but not nearly as much as the arsenic and cadmium, which didn't get much attention until the 1980s because people were so concerned about the sulfur dioxide. If you take a look at the Asarco smelter and compare it to some of the other Western copper smelters, you can see that it was one of the least regulated of the copper smelters in terms of percentage removal of sulfur dioxide. There are, of course, a couple. One in Douglas, Arizona, which is now closed, and Kennecott and McGill, Nevada, which I think is also closed, that had no controls whatsoever.
That's really strange, and it is probably in the, more in a population center than any of the others that you see there.
Asarco?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course, you're saying it went in about 1900.
That's right.
Very populated then.
That's right. You know, today people are going after the Asarco smelter in El Paso for sulfur dioxide emissions because it's still right here at the 65% control rate, and basically it's been in violation of federal law since 1971. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Kind of a dry subject, made very
I have a question.
Yeah.
Why was the smelter built in
here? Look at this pair.
Two reasons. It was the terminus of the railroad, and it was a deep water port. And it was originally built as a lead smelter. And there were lead ores somewhat closer by that could be brought in by rail. You know, the railroad was first brought to Tacoma and then later brought to Seattle.
Hmm. Oh, that's right.
So that was the main, and the deep water port right there. And also, William Rust was in Tacoma.
This is my town.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
You know, if you look back to the turn of the century in Western Washington, there were actually a bunch of little smelter operations and stuff that were built.
Was there?
And this is just one that happened to get sold and last. Stay around.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. You know, when the Guggenheims came in and brought real capital, that's when it really started getting expanded and built into something big. And if, you know, if the Guggenheims had bought a smelter somewhere else, it probably would have been the one.
Okay. Yeah. So where was that refinery? Was that closer to the port?
To the yacht club.
Oh, closer to the yacht club.
Yeah, the brick buildings that are down toward the yacht club. That's the refinery.
Oh. So what's the other big smokestack in Tacoma then?
It's Kaiser Aluminum.
Okay. When did that close?
It's open.
It's still open?
Yeah, it's built in 1947.
Okay.
It's the oldest aluminum smelter in the Northwest.
Because it looks, you don't see anything coming out of the stack.
No.
Anymore, like you used to.
Right. That main thing that comes out of the stack is fluoride gas, gaseous fluoride, fluoride salt, and some complex aromatic hydrocarbons and benzoate pyrene, et cetera, and carbon monoxide.
Oh, okay.
You can't see any of them.
Yeah.
Thank you.
But can't see, no.
I guess